This programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee. Welcome to In the Elfless Time, I'm Marita Kelly. In this, the fifth episode, I look at wildlife, which sometimes comes into conflict with commercial farming. So first off, I'm at Kildalton Agricultural College to meet with Tagus Countryside Management Specialist Catherine Keena to explore the effects intensive farming has on the natural world.
Yeah, well, I suppose when you think back to the 40s and 50s, the countryside in Ireland was very different. You had small farms, mixed farms, tillage, small fields. It was a very biodiverse, picturesque place. And then in the last, only the last 60 years or so, I suppose with the advent of fertiliser, pesticides, machinery to remove things, intensification has happened at a pace, you know, not seen in the previous thousands of years. So I suppose that has put huge pressure on, it has changed basically the landscape and put huge pressure on wildlife in particular.
But how can we gauge the effect commercial farming is having on wildlife?
The birds are a good indicator, I suppose. First of all, people, we see them. And also, if they're performing well, it means that the insects and the base of the food chain is there. So we often use birds as indicators of what's there. There's a number of groups of birds that have done particularly badly. In Ireland, the seed-eating birds are practically gone from the west because of the move of tillage, specialisation of tillage in the southeast. So while we still have yellowhammer in the southeast, it's almost gone from parts of the country. Corn bunting is one which has become extinct altogether. So the seed-eating birds have disappeared from the areas because tillage has disappeared. So that's specialisation of rather than intensification. The group of wetland birds then are faring very badly as well. Ones that would have been common everywhere, the snipe, the curlew, the lapwing, those that would depend on wetter areas for probing, they're the ones, they all tend to have the long beaks. The seed-eating birds have the little beaks for biting the seeds. And the wetland birds, the waders, breeding waders, have long beaks. So they need soft mud and they feed on the insects and they need to be able to probe into the mud. So when land is drained, soil becomes hard. They're also ground nesting birds and they are in particular trouble then when they're at nesting time. And as their habitat kind of gets reduced, there's also more of an effect of predation. So foxes are a big threat to them.
The fauna of Ireland comprises of all the animal species inhabiting the island and surrounding waters. But what changes have occurred in their stock levels? I've come to Ballyvergan Wildlife Sanctuary in Cork to meet with biologist John Whelan-Curtin. With living on a farm in Waterford, I can't help but notice how fond deer in the locality are of breaking our electric fence wire. And being a farmer as well, I wonder has John noticed a variation in the deer population?
I know that they went very, very low, obviously, back if you go back a century or so. They had dropped an awful lot because we were hunting them so actively and we're doing nothing to protect them. At the moment, again, they're having to be controlled actively. What's working to control, well, within reason, what's working to control them is the fact that you just, the department actually regulates the number of licenses it'll give out. And if you buy a deer license, you're actually obliged to kill a minimum number as well as a maximum number. So you're allowed to take a certain number of animals out of the wild for your own, for your freezer, for your venison burgers. But you're also obliged to kill a minimum number as well, because that's how the department is actually regulating their populations. But again, there's a certain argument that maybe the population's coming up too high, that we're not doing enough to control them, and it may be a big call will be, you know, or maybe a lot of freedom in the licences will be looked at in the next few years.
Over the last 6 years then, how have the fish stock levels of the River Blackwater changed?
The fish stock levels have dropped off, and they've dropped off quite noticeably. I know it myself. I mean, like trout fishing, if you go on, even on the small rivers, what you consider a big trout is not a big trout. You know, it's a puny little thing compared with what the father's generation or the grandfather's generation remember catching.
Why have they become smaller?
They've become smaller because the populations are getting poorer, and that was a combination of, again, eutrophication from overuse of nitrates, chemicals running off into the water, the DDTs, and these guys would have knocked them down. So we drove their population down so far.
And what are we trying to do to bring them back?
Well, we're licensing fishing for a start. You know, like, so we're controlling fishing. You have to get your license. You can only fish during a certain time of the year. Well, you can only keep a trout above a certain size. And then the other massive things we're doing, and I know drives us mental, but we're only allowed to spread X number of kgs of nitrates per year. We're only allowed to put out so much of our organic matters. We're only allowed to use certain chemicals in terms of pesticides and insecticides, and only under certain conditions. So all of these things are designed to protect our waterways. And that's what they're doing, because the trout levels do appear to be coming back, just slowly. And the same thing, you talk to people on the Blackwater, and of course the big one, the salmon stocks, how they do seem to have dropped off, and quite significantly, despite all the controls we're using, despite all the regulations, despite all the licenses, how the numbers are still dropping, or are certainly are nothing like what they would have been historically. So the stock levels do appear to have come down. The reasons for it are multifold. There's so many reasons why we could have problems. Of course, you know, we've been netting, you know, and we've been netting for a long time in Ireland, both on the river and outside the river. And again, if you look specifically at salmon, they've got such a complex life cycle. They go way out into the Atlantic. They live out there for a number of years before they come back here to breed and then die. It's such a complex system that it's so easy to interrupt it.
But there is always going to be a conflict between wildlife and commercial farming.
Absolutely. I mean, like we cracked the 7 billion mark, you know, in terms of population. There are 7 billion people on the planet. The only way we can support these people is by encroaching. In fact, you know, we're almost actively, without meaning to be, we're almost actively in opposition with the natural world, because we need ground to produce food.
Badgers are responsible for one of the biggest clashes between farmers and the natural world. But are they the principal source of TB in Ireland?
Badgers do carry TB, right? This is a fact. We know this. The big part of the conversation is, are badgers spreading TB in Ireland? Are they the reason we've got a TB problem? And what can be done about it? And there's all this talk of a cull. As it stands right now, I don't think there's enough evidence that badgers are the primary agent for the spreading of TB to go off and do a cull. And I'll go so far as to say is that if I thought it would have a very significant impact on our industry, that it would actually, you know, turn farms that are struggling because they're in TB hot zones, and if we could fix that problem and turn those farms into, again, livelihoods for the men who own them, I'd have very little to say against the culls, provided they were conducted responsibly. There's so many agents, vectors are what I call them, animals that spread disease. We have so many vectors here. It is very hard to say with any certainty that badgers are doing it alone. To control it here in terms of wildlife vectors is probably impossible. But that doesn't mean we can't eradicate TB. The systems we have here have had an incredible impact on, you know, just the actual regular, no, I know it's a pain, but the regular testing and culling that we do here has had an incredible impact.
Stock levels of other prominent wildlife have changed over the years too.
Pheasant are not native to Ireland.
No.
I did not know this.
Yeah, pheasant are Asian. They come from, I suppose our first pheasants here probably came from around China ways, you know. They were introduced as a game species. That's literally where they came from. They're ornamental anyway, and it's, you know, like they're very, very closely related to the peacocks and the other fowl, we'll say, the wild fowl. And they were just brought in here for hunting. They're a great game bird because they're, well, I don't think anyone who's eaten pheasant can argue that they're not delicious, you know.
Gorgeous.
They're very attractive. They make a great game bird for lots of reasons. They're also beautiful to spot out in the wild as well. So literally, they were brought onto estates as something for wealthy lords with nothing better to be doing than to be knocking out of the sky, basically. Rabbits were imported as well, you know.
Where did rabbits come from?
Rabbits came from Europe. They were mainland Europe animals, and then around the time the Normans came in, there was very little to hunt. So they said, we'll let a few rabbits off, and it led to a massive ecological disaster, really. So they're only here with 700 years-ish.
Why was it a massive ecological fault?
Because if you even go back, I suppose, about 60 years, and talk, you know, you ask farmers now who were farming maybe 60 years ago and ask them about rabbits, the woes they had, because rabbits came in here, as we know, rabbits breed like rabbits, rabbits reproduce at a mad rate, and into that, like, while we do have animals here that will predate on them, that will hunt them, the likes of the buzzards and the foxes and so forth, so rabbits were producing mad. There was very little, as much as a fox will take a rabbit, as much as a buzzard will take a rabbit, there wasn't enough here that could actively control their populations. And as a result, the population was wild. Again, if you talk to farmers back in around the you know, pre-50s, rabbits were at, you know, multiples of what they are now. And you think about like how towards the end of sugar beet there, how farmers could be complaining of losing thousands of euros to rabbit damage a year, and it was many, many times worse if you went back another 50 or 60 years ago. So it was quite, you know, any time an invasive species comes in, there's always a risk of a disaster. And rabbits just happen to be one of those. Anywhere they've been introduced, they've been disastrous, like Australia as well, the same. They just reproduce so quickly. They eat so voraciously. And it does take a, like, you know, I know they mightn't be the brightest creatures on the planet, but there it takes a lot to sneak up on one. They're very, very well designed to survive, you know.
Can you tell me a bit about myxomatosis in rabbits, John?
Myxi was discovered in South America. It was an endemic disease there with the native lagomorphs, which is the rabbits, hares, all these kinds of guys. But when settlers started bringing rabbits in fact, I think it was there at the very turn of the 1900s, it was actually lab rabbits started getting sick with the disease and dropping dead. The notion came across, oh, we've got a great way now to control rabbits. This thing is vicious. Like, originally, Myxi would kill like more than 99% of rabbits that got infected. Two rabbits inoculated, yeah, and within 2 years, 90% of the rabbits in France were dead. It was introduced into the UK then a couple of years later, and again, after 2 years, after the introduction, 95% of the rabbits in the UK were dead. And it had a very similar, it was around the 95% mark it hit over here as well in the 1950s, which was, aside from how brutal it is, a godsend to farmers, because it saved them the equivalent of thousands and thousands of euros a year in crop damage, which was massive. It's called a biocontrol when you bring in a natural agent to try and do your dirty work, basically. But it's a brutal disease, and it really is. It's the symptoms now, they get little skin tumours. Blindness apparently is an occasional occurrence. I've never seen a rabbit with Myxi without blindness. They eventually suffocate to death because their respiratory system gets so clogged up. It takes up to 2 weeks to die. It's savage, and it's so viral. It's so infectious. If you see, you know, if you've hutches of rabbits, if one of them gets hit by Myxi, it's going to spread. You know, you can almost take it as a guarantee you've lost all your rabbits. You know,
is there anything you can do?
You can vaccinate against it. In terms of treatment, there's almost nothing that can be done. It's really, really vicious.
Back at Kildalton Agricultural College, Catherine Keane explains the effect intensive farming has had on flora.
Yeah, I suppose, again, coming back 60 years ago, the meadows would be full of many different varieties of flora. Now, ryegrass is the common one for in reseeded ones. So, and is obviously the most productive in dry matter production terms. It's the one we need for farming. However, there's a lot of interest in old meadows, species-rich grassland, and the schemes, REPS and EOS, and hopefully the new scheme will continue to reward farmers for farming these in a way that will maintain them. We try to maintain the old species-rich grasslands that we do have. It's worth retaining those and managing them. And also then in the tillage situation, we're particularly worried about the bees in there because they're needed for pollinating the crops. Many farmers bring in beehives, but we also need to look after the other 100 native bee species and the honeybee. So one thing we can do there is to grow flowering strips for them. Like we grow flowering crops for birds, you know, to seed-eating birds. We've been doing that through the schemes in the last few years, growing crops of oats and linseed and leaving them basically like a giant bird table over the winter. So instead of you putting out the feed, the farmer has an acre of feed that, rather than cutting it and harvesting it, is standing there for the birds to eat during the winter.
The nitrates regulations have played a considerable role in the way farming has changed. Fertiliser is like a store corporate ingredient for farmers, but it has only really developed in the last century. However, restrictions on its usage have been put in place to limit its effect on the natural world. Farmers must not apply more than 170 kgs of nitrogen from livestock manure per hectare per year and within a specific time frame, as John Whelan Curtin tells us.
So since 1914 it was discovered, and particularly since it's around 1960 on, we've been using it so much, we've no idea what we're doing, and there are certainly negative impacts being shown. We see it, like, immediate ones can be seen when there's an, when we put out too much, particularly before we had any regulation. You'd fire it out, you'd keep firing it out, it would run off into water systems. So, like, there's an immediate thing. And we see this happens on a regular basis, as good as we are. There's always some little boo-boo here or boo-boo there that results in a lot of runoff going into the water. So in terms of what's actually happening to wildlife, the problem is it's very hard to quantify. Because apart from the nitrates, there's also pesticides, there's also habitat destruction, there's also the more intensive farming techniques. Effectively today, every second person on the planet would be starving if it wasn't for fertilizer. Fertilizer feeds about half the planet. So, you know, about 50% of our global products is a result of fertilizer.
Despite causing much disquiet, nitrates are responsible for increasing our productivity.
I love our natural habitat. I love it so much. And I love anything we can do to help it is terrific. But at the same time, we have to look at the facts. And the fact is that in Ireland, we can support something like 4.2 people per hectare. That's up from about 2.2 before artificial fertilizers. China, where they have no nitrogen restrictions at all, they can support almost 10 people per hectare. That's more than double what we can carry. So as much as we say nitrates are bad, if a farmer wants to feed his family, nitrates are one of his greatest assets. And if we want to feed the world, again, nitrates are one of our greatest assets. It's not that there's nothing bad about them. Of course, there's tons of problems with it, but we have to be practical too.
The effect pesticides have on wildlife also causes divided opinion.
The story of pesticides has improved an awful lot over recent times. The EU and in fairness, the American counterparts the same, have gotten very effective at measuring the effects of pesticides. And the chemical winds up in plants, and little herbivores like mice will say, right, they eat a lot of those plants. So it builds up in them. But then the predators, the likes of the buzzards and the various falcons, they're eating these little mammals who already have accumulated a certain amount, and it's accumulating it's multiplying inside the apex predators, like the birds of prey.
Do we have any positives about pesticides?
Well, the positives of pesticides, again, is part of that. You know, if half of the planet is being fed from nitrates, you know, well, there's got to be 5, 10, 20% of the food we're producing would be eaten by pests if we weren't controlling them. So pesticides are massive. Obviously, they're doing nothing positive for our environment, really, except for the rare instances around the world where an invasive alien insect or invasive alien pest gets in and has to be knocked back. So again, the actual wildlife authorities might use certain poisons. But generally speaking, for our wildlife, you know, the pesticides are doing nothing there. But of course, you know, anyone again who likes to go down to the supermarket and get their food and actually have change out of their 10 euro, 20 euro, 50 euro note, we'll be glad we're using it, because otherwise we'd have less food and it would be more expensive and there would be more hungry people in the world, you know. So obviously all of these things are massive, you know, and they're really, really important for the industry. But the industry is going to conflict, and it's inevitable we're going to conflict with the natural world. But we've gotten very good.
The Rural Environmental Protection Scheme was set up to reward farmers for carrying out farming activities in an environmentally friendly manner and to bring about environmental improvement on existing farms. I'm on the farm of Kevin Green, who entered REPS. Why did you enter REPS, Kevin?
I entered REPS because I thought the idea behind REPS suited what we're doing here on the farm, and it suited the way that we farm, and I'd had the idea of cutting hedges and keeping the place tidy was a good idea, and it was just to make the place neat and tidy for passing tools. We had to plant 180 metres of hawthorn hedge to create what they call a wildlife corridor. We had to naturally upgrade the boundary fence, generally tidy up the farmyard, paint sheds. That was about it, really. That was the kernel of it, you know.
Is your ground SSE ground?
No, it isn't, no.
When you entered REPS, Kevin, did you have to change your ways of farming?
Slightly. We had to lower our stocking rate to facilitate REPS, because when our animals are out of winter, you can only have so many animals roaming the land in the winter time, and that's it, and there's a limit to that. So to prevent damage to the soil and everything. So we reckon that even by lowering our animals, it still made financial sense for us to join REPS, because it evened out. The lesser animals you had, even to cut the animals, cut the stocking rate, it balanced out with what you get in REPS per year, and you hadn't as much work to do in the first place.
You say you changed your animals. What animals did you change from?
We changed from Frisians to Aberdeen Angus and Hereford, and cut out Frisians, you know, because they're so suited to outwintering.
But obviously to outwinter then, Kevin, your land must be suitable.
It is suited to it, yeah. It's a very dry farm and the fields are reasonably big, so when you have cattle out in the winter time, they're not standing in the same place kind of twice, you know, they're not cutting up the fields as much as they would if you had a lot of cattle confined to, say, 10 or 12 acre fields. We give them 70, 80 acres on one side of the road and the rest of it on the other side of the road. So you have cattle on one side and you have cows on the other. We just rotate the cattle and the cows have free rein, and that's the way it works out, you know.
But you can almost judge the weather by them.
You can, yeah. We've seen it here from time to time, but if the night is going to be bad, cattle and cows, the cows specifically, it'll go to the land up higher, you know, that's up higher. And if the night is going to be bad, they'll just go down to the glen. And you'll just see them heading off at 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening, and they know, they'll tell you if the nights are going to be good or bad.
Is this passed down then from generation to generation?
It is, yeah, without doubt, yeah. We have calves that could be a week old, and they can find shelter. In a bad day, they can, you know, they might only be just born a few days, and next thing, if a shower comes, they know what ditch to go to, and they'll find shelter.
And how have the cows adapted, Kevin, to outwintering over the years?
Well, what I've noticed with cows and cattle is that they grow their hair an inch longer in the winter time, so that they're warm in the winter, and of course they're moving around at night, they're not cold anyway, and I think personally they have a lot of better lifestyle outside than they would have if they were wintered indoors.
The REP scheme is coming to an end and being replaced with GLOSS. So to find out how important these environmental schemes are to farmers, I've come to the offices of farm accountant John Broderick.
The REP scheme was there for circa 15 years. That scheme was a whole farm scheme where all of your lands owned had to be kind of farmed under certain conditions. The payments under that scheme ranged from, I suppose, nearly £5,000 up to circa €8,000. And that payment really, it found its way by and large 100% in many cases back to farmers. They had to enhance facilities on their farms in terms of slurry storage. They had to fence water streams. They had to kind of increase the fertility of their land by adjusting the pH by lime application. There was a lot of positives there. The environment was being protected and the fertility of the soil was being enhanced. The wintering facilities were being improved on farms, and it really gave a greater kind of, let's say, boost to a lot of family farms because that money meant a better lifestyle for many of the farmers.
But the new scheme GLOSS is capped at a reduced payment. Let's hear the thoughts of Kevin Green.
It wanted to yield at least 5,000 anyway to make it worthwhile, to keep farming the way you're going, keep cutting your hedges and maintaining this wildlife corridor and doing the various things that you need to do to keep the farm looking well and keep it looking tidy and everything. That doesn't come without a cost. So the longer it keeps going, the better for all concerned.
So over the years then, Catherine, how has rural landscape changed?
Well, again, I suppose we've come from lots of traditional farm buildings and traditional houses to, I suppose, the housing really has changed the countryside more than anything, the modern houses.
But we would have lost a lot of rainforest over the years.
We did lose a lot in tillage areas, yes. Now, a lot are still beneath the surface, of course, because with archaeology, a lot of the interesting things remain beneath the surface. You know, the pishrugs of not interfering with them would have helped them, saved them. What we'd like is just farmers to keep grazing those areas, not damaging them, not causing surface damage, but just to graze them, because roots or letting trees grow on them or even planting trees is not a good idea because the roots will interfere with whatever. There's a lot of valuable stuff beneath the ground. Whether we ever excavate it or not, it is there. So I think it is fascinating. I mean, it's a part of our past, you know, and without a past, it's hard to look to the future.
And looking to the future, what are Catherine and John's hopes of commercial farming and wildlife conservation working in harmony together?
What I would feel most sad is if a farmer said to me, I'm sorry I did that. So, you know, I think awareness and, you know, programs like this are very important to kind of just get people to think before you think, oh, I must do it. Sometimes, and even at the beginning of REPS, there was a kind of a craze of tidying up. But tidying up can also, you know, be the wrong thing to do.
I'm hopeful. I'll be ever hopeful. But I'm not optimistic. Like reps did a lot of good things, you know. And again, like the restrictions we have are doing a lot of good things, not for farmers, but for in fact most of what we're doing is quite harsh on the farmers. But in terms of the conservation, it's quite positive. In my opinion, a lot of things are being done wrong. We seem to jump out and fire out restrictions and regulations where we've very little actual scientific data to support what we're doing. And we'll make whole-scale changes to regulations in the country about how we do anything, from how we drive our cars to how we farm our land, without really being able to support it conclusively. So we're shooting in the dark an awful lot of the time here. My problem with reps was that, like, again, it was good, but I felt like it missed on an awful lot of targets. I felt like it never seemed to know where it was going either. And I have very similar feelings about the new schemes as well, is that they're going to do the same thing. It's the same way that I'd be critical a little bit of the organic farming regulations we have in this country, because they do seem to miss the mark a little bit in terms of the way, like you can't be organic farmed and GM at the same time. Now, I'm not saying I'm pro-GM. What I'm saying is that I'm open to GM, because genetically modified organisms provide so much opportunity. Again, in a world where we're at 7 billion, we're going to be at 20 billion in the next few decades. We need to find ways to feed the planet. And if you want to do that in ways that don't involve the use of chemicals or nitrates or any of these things, then genetically modified organisms present us with a very unique opportunity. And again, organic farming doesn't allow that. So there's this unsupported notion that genes we introduce to genetically modified plants will find their way somehow into the microbes living in the ground or into wild species. So again, we're very anti-GM in this country without any facts to back up why. You know, we've no reason to be, except that we've speculated. And the same thing is, I feel like that an awful lot of the schemes we use here, and that we've been using, and unfortunately in all likelihood that we'll continue to use, are speculation. That are, they're based on little or no fact in many cases. Now, of course, there's other times where what we've done has been absolutely factually based, where we've limited nitrates because we've seen what it's done and we've been able to calculate it.
Well, I think the future is looking better, in the sense that we're now conscious of it, and conscious of not reducing it. And the schemes, and there's lots of protection there, and also the schemes like we had reps and EOS, and we're waiting the new GLAS scheme, will target, you know, where there are problems, and encourage farmers and pay farmers, because farming is a business. And if we want to have, like, we want to have food production, but we also want to have these other public goods of the landscape and biodiversity and water quality and air. So the farmer will be paid for those through single farm payment, agri-environment schemes. So I think that principle is well established now. We don't expect a farmer to do something for nothing, because it is a business, and it just won't work that way. Because if he doesn't run his business, he won't be here.
Definitely getting better at balancing the conflict between the natural world and commercial farming. Join me in the sixth and final episode of In the Alpha's Time, when I look at rural life. In the Alpha's Time was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee, presented and produced by Marita Kelly, and edited by Sean Healy, a Community Radio Yall production.